And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, from Radio Derb's lavishly equipped sound studio here on the 95th floor of Buckley Towers in the heart of Manhattan. This is your hibernically genial host, John Derbyshire, with a survey of the passing Charivari. My team of superbly trained sound technicians are at their consoles, under the wise supervision of Ahmed, our sound manager. Say hello to the listeners, Ahmed.
Death to all infidels.
Right. My dedicated research assistants, Mandy, Candy and Brandy, are collating over at the side there. Say hello, girls.
Hi!
The producer there behind his glass screen is gesticulating with his rod of office. And so off we go. Sometimes the news is just the news. Stuff happens. It gets fairly reported. We chew over it for significance. And then it slips away into the old news file. Other times, though, the real news is not the news itself, but the way it got reported. We depend for our picture of events on a few thousand journalists, who are unlike America in a lot of ways. They vote about 80% Democrat, for example. Most of the time you can discount for this, but now and then an event stirs their own preconceptions and prejudices in such a way that they go into a collective psychic state that is newsworthy in itself. That happened twice this week, so I'm going to look at those two stories, not so much as news stories, as instructive as concerning the mindset of MSM journalists. MSM stands for Mainstream Media, if you haven't met that one before. First, the shooting in France. The news story here was a crazy person shooting a teacher and three children at a school in Toulouse, southern France, on Monday. It was a Jewish school, and in fact the teacher was a rabbi. Now, in the head of your average MSM journalist, the phrase "wanton killing of Jews" triggers the response, "Neo-Nazi." As it happens, France has a presidential election scheduled for a month from now, and one of the candidates is Marine Le Pen of the National Front Party, who's been polling between 15 and 20%. Not bad in a broad field. The National Front is an ethno-nationalist party, opposed to multiculturalism and mass immigration. And just a word about that before I go on. There are ethno-nationalist parties all over Europe now, and they're doing pretty well, although mostly under a 20 to 25% ceiling of voter approval. Probably best known is Geert Wilders' Freedom Party in the Netherlands, now the third largest party in the Dutch parliament. The Swiss People's Party, actually the largest party now in the Federal Assembly, would be better known if anyone gave a fig about Swiss politics. The Sweden Democrats is similarly oriented. So are Vlaams Belang in Belgium and the UK Independence Party in Britain, with its less genteel cousin, the British National Party. Once again, the common factor here is ethno-nationalism, hostility to multiculturalism and mass immigration, most especially mass Islamic immigration. The knee-jerk descriptor for these parties in the MSM is far right. That's sloppy. On economics, these parties are all over the place, from Geert Wilders' libertarianism to the state socialism of Britain's BNP. The proper word for these parties is ethno-nationalist. The idea that a nation needs to correspond pretty closely to an ethne. That is, a people of common ancestry, sharing a common language and culture, all rooted in the territory of that nation. If you want to look up ethno-nationalism, I recommend Walker Connor's book about it, with that title. It's not a bad idea. It was held by well-nigh everybody until about 50 years ago, and it's still the default mentality in big and important countries. In China, for example, and Japan. I've been hanging out with Chinese people for 45 years, and let me say, if you have a plan to wean them off their ethno-nationalism, I wish you all the luck in the world. Okay, back to our dimwit MSM journalists. They hear about some lunatic shooting up a Jewish school, and their minds bring up the far right tag. The image that goes with the tag is some snaggletooth militiaman type with prison tattoos and a collection of SS regalia in his closet. Isn't that what the far right is all about? So, obviously, this shooter was some National Front supporter hoping to rally the vote by offing a few of the hated other. It sounds absurd, but that's exactly how the incident was first reported, as MSM journalists' knees first started to jerk. The palm probably goes to Fiara Gibbons of the London Guardian, who was first out of the box Monday, right after the shootings, with a fine foam-flecked piece originally headlined, "French Right Caught Up in the Storm It Helped Create." Sample, long quote. "The French airwaves have been full of ugly equivocation this past few weeks as Nicolas Sarkozy has lurched his party wildly to the right in an attempt to save his skin, claiming there were, quote, too many immigrants in France and stoking Islamophobia. Today in Toulouse, we have been given a horrific illustration of where such delirious cynicism can lead. All of those who have been shot or killed in and around the city in the past 8 days have had one thing in common. They are from visible minorities." End long quote. I should add, by the way, that the Toulouse shooter had also, in the previous week, shot three soldiers, all of them Muslims. Now, so you see here, these evil nativists are down on visible minorities. That's the root of the issue here. The New York Times was not to be outdone. Their Tuesday report was headlined, "Killings Could Stall Elections Nationalist Turn." Sample, quote, "The political debate around the shootings and whether the deaths of an instructor and three young children were somehow inspired by anti-immigrant political talk is likely to continue. In the middle of a long and heated presidential campaign, with President Nicolas Sarkozy trying to win back disaffected supporters who have drifted to the far-right National Front Party, the shootings at Toulouse have raised new questions about the tone and tenor of the debate here about what it is to be French." That's the end of the New York Times quote. So again, what do these wise pundits think is going on here? It's nativism. It's nationalism. It's anti-immigrant sentiment. It's those far-right parties stirring things up. Those are the narrow, petty little categories in which they think. When the news came out on Wednesday that the gunman was named Mohammed Merah, that he was a jihadi and an Al-Qaeda postulant, and that no tattooed neo-Nazis at all were involved in the atrocity, there must have been some severe cognitive dissonance going on in the heads of these MSM nitwits. The fact that Mera had been raised in France by immigrant Algerian parents might have suggested, to people capable of joined-up thinking, that the ethno-nationalist parties have a point. Connected thought and cognitive dissonance, however, don't fit well together in the same skull. One of the things that had led the MSM bobbleheads astray was the fact of Mohammed Mera's victims at the school being Jewish. In this particular zone, MSM types haven't noticed much of what's happened in the world since 1945. They hear wanton killing of Jews, and the phrase neo-Nazi comes right up, followed by far-right, nativist, and all the rest. They have a vague recollection of stories in their own newspapers about rising anti-Semitism in Europe, which is a true fact. Not having taken in anything that's actually been happening in Europe for a few decades, they do not know, and would be surprised to be told, that all the rising anti-Semitism over there is being fueled by mass immigration of Muslims. You can take Mohammed Mera as a poster boy here. Or, if that's a bit too fresh for you, any one of hundreds of others, going back at least as far, to jump the Atlantic again, as the Brooklyn Bridge shooting of 1994, when Lebanese immigrant Rashid Baz strafed a van belonging to an Orthodox Jewish school, killing one student and permanently disabling another. The role of Europe's ethno-nationalist parties here is negligible. It's mostly less than negligible, as the old anti-Semitic elements were purged out from those parties a generation ago. I've been following the affairs of Britain's ethno-nationalists since my days as a student lefty, and I can tell you that while you'd have to put one of my vital organs in a vice to make me vote for the BNP's Nick Griffin, I'll give him credit for cleansing his party of all that. Geert Wilders is the biggest philo-Semite you'll find in a long journey. He seems to spend half his time shuttling to Israel and back. Even Austria's ethno-nationalist party, the Freedom Party, has shucked off its anti-Semitic past and had friendly meetings with Israeli politicians. Hungary's Jobbik party is a bit of a holdout, still harbouring anti-Semitic elements, but a couple more tranches of Muslim immigration will fix that. Europe's ethno-nationalist parties, what your New York Times calls the far right, are not anti-Jewish. They're anti-Islam, with very good reason, as we saw in France on Monday. And they are certainly not anti-Israel. Why on earth would they be? Their common denominator, as I keep telling you, is ethno-nationalism. And what nation in the European zone of awareness is more ethno-nationalist than Israel? The major majority opinion in Israel is that the country is one for Jews and ought to be kept that way. Any ethno-nationalist from elsewhere is going to raise a cheer on hearing that. That's all much too deep for your average MSM liberal journalist. Like liberals everywhere, his emotions are not stirred by thinking of strange people speaking foreign languages. The driving force of his life is competition within his own ethnic, determination to assert his moral superiority over those coarse hillbillies clinging to their guns and religion, and occasionally going berserk to kill blacks or Jews because of the deep moral turpitude in their unwashed, illiberal souls. That brings us to the second story of the week, in which the reporting is as much of a story as the story. That's the Trayvon Martin case. This all started 4 weeks ago when Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old Florida high school student, was found shot and killed in Sanford, Florida, a town north of Orlando. I'll just pause to look up Sanford on citydata.com. Population 51,000. Median household income 42,000. That's a tad below the Florida average. Detached house, average price 202,000. 44% married. Racial breakdown, white 47%, black 30%, Hispanic 17%. So it sounds like a humdrum lower middle class community. Okay, so 4 weeks ago, there's Trayvon Martin lying dead of a gunshot wound. The shooter is on site when the cops show up. 28-year-old George Zimmerman, captain of the local neighbourhood watch. Mr. Zimmerman has a bloody nose, an impact wound in the back of his head, and grass stains on the back of his shirt. Mr. Zimmerman tells cops, who know him from his neighbourhood watch role, that he killed Martin in self-defence. The police do not arrest him, as Florida law does allow you to shoot someone in self-defence. A couple of weeks go by, and now Martin's family is asking for an arrest. Last Friday, a local ABC News affiliate published the 911 calls at the time of the shooting. They don't tell us anything much, but people are by now primed to hear what they want to hear in them. Around this point, it being a pretty slow weekend, and Trayvon Martin having been black, the MSM dimbos suddenly wake up to what they've got. What have they got? A great white defendant, that's what. You'll recall Tom Wolfe's 1985 novel Bonfire of the Vanities, in which the Bronx District Attorney's office is so weary and guilt-ridden at processing the steady stream of black and Hispanic perps, when they finally get a white one, it's like Christmas Day for them. The great white defendant. This is a recurring phenomenon in the MSM news cycle. The Duke University rape case was a recent example. Well, once they realised they'd got a great white defendant in harpoon range, the MSM went nuts. The story they hastily put together was that a feral white guy had gunned down a harmless young black man, for no reason whatsoever. The stories were decorated with pictures of Trayvon Martin as a winsome preteen. No pictures of him at his actual age of 17 apparently being available, or perhaps just not suitable. We also got pictures of Zimmerman, fleshy and scowling. No selection going on there at all, guys, I'm sure. There was a slight hiccup in the accumulating narrative when it turned out that Zimmerman, his name notwithstanding, is actually Hispanic. There are various accounts of this, I don't know which one is true. I've heard that he is a Spanish-speaking Guatemalan, adopted into a Jewish family. Also that he's half Jewish, half Puerto Rican, and a couple of other versions. Anyway, the luster came off for the MSM a teeny bit. Hispanic guy shoots black kid just doesn't send quite the same tingle up the MSM leg as white guy shoots black kid. Still, you work with what you've got. Trayvon Martin was undoubtedly dead, and undoubtedly unarmed at the time of the encounter, other than with a pack of Skittles candy, a very handy prop to go with all those winsome kid pictures. We haven't been told much else about him. He stood 6'3", considerably taller than Zimmerman. He was also way fitter than Zimmerman, who is 100 pounds overweight. He played school football, and so presumably spent time in the weight room. He was a, quote, model student, said the first reports. Then we learned that he was on a 5-day suspension from school, presumably not for being a model student. What about the considerable evidence that at the time of his death, Trayvon Martin had George Zimmerman on the ground and was pounding the bejesus out of him? Whoosh! That's something going down the memory hole. With all its deficiencies, the story will do. It was time for another great white defendant story, and the MSM have stepped up to supply one. Again, I take no position on the facts of the case, which are mostly unknown or ambiguous, and which I'm sure will be clarified in due course. What I'm taking a position on is the fact that the MSM, in full shrieking battle cry, have taken a position on the facts, ignoring known ones that don't fit their narrative and twisting the ambiguous ones to favour that narrative. Meanwhile, the story continues to metastasize. Activists here in New York City staged a riot on Trayvon Martin's behalf the other day. I assume that's what happened anyway. The AM New York headline read, "Protesters clash with NYPD in rally for Trayvon Martin, OWS. If clashing with police isn't a riot, what is? And notice there, the OWS, that's Occupy Wall Street, the OWS rabble getting in on the act too. This show will run and run. Meanwhile, last weekend, just in the city of Chicago, that's the one our young president community organised with such dramatic results, in Chicago last weekend, gangbangers murdered 10 people and wounded another 40. The youngest murder victim is only 6 years old. The youngest person wounded is only 1 year old. Many of the victims were pedestrians, sprayed with bullets in drive-by shootings. Is that news? I guess not. No great white defendant there. Heck, not even a great Hispanic defendant. No, sorry, I'm feeling no tingle up my leg at all. More news from Africa following last week's roundup. Last week I upbraided the administration and clueless stool pigeons like Senator Inhofe for getting us involved in Uganda, a place that is not merely of zero importance to the USA, but is of zero importance to anybody, and will always be so. Well, the Obamaroids must have been listening. They determined to show Radio Derb and other sceptics that when it comes to squandering money we don't actually have, in places that nobody ever could, ever has, or ever will give a flying falafel about, they are not to be mocked. To make their point, they are now about to get us involved in a country, using the term loosely, so inconsequential it makes Uganda look like the People's Republic of China. The country in question is Mali, a sand trap in between Niger, Mauritania and Algeria. If you still can't place it, don't bother looking it up. You will never need to know anything about Mali. Trust me on that. I'm just going to read you the wire service report here. Quote, "The Obama administration is weighing the future of military aid to Mali after soldiers in the African country ousted their president and declared a coup." State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland said no decision has been made. She said officials would meet Thursday to talk about the $137 million in annual U.S. counterterrorism and other assistance. Nuland wouldn't call it a coup. She expressed the hope that, quote, military action could quickly be reversed so that Mali returns to democratic governance. The U.S. has long cited Mali as an African example of a thriving democracy. The White House also condemned the violence in Mali and voiced support for Mali's president, Amadou Toumani Touré. That's the end of the wire service quote. My private bet would be that our dear friend President Amadou Toumani Touré is at this moment thriving in a big old iron cooking pot in the public square of Timbuktu, while the townsfolk are laying out the silverware. But I'm just guessing. And here we are, $17 trillion in debt, cities declaring bankruptcy all over, unemployment limping along at 8 to 9%, and our lords and masters in Washington, D.C., are shoveling 137 million greenbacks a year into the Swiss bank accounts of the generals, of the army, of a country that, if it ceased to exist at the stroke of midnight tomorrow, nobody would notice was gone. We are the fools of the world and the dupes of all time, the sorry laughing stock of the ages. Well, it's short measure this week, listeners. I'm not going to feel guilty, though, because A, last week's Radio Derb was quite exceptionally long, and B, I'm going to sign off with a lovely and unusually long piece of music. Somewhere in between recording last week's Radio Derb and recording this week's, there came St. Patrick's Day. I lacked the forethought to include a tribute last week, so I'm going to make up for it here. Here is one of the loveliest and, to my way of thinking, most spontaneously Irish of all the Irish exile ballads. You'll get an argument from lovers of Irish ballads. In fact, if you're in an Irish bar, you'll quite likely get a fist fight. You'll get an argument about whose interpretation is the best. I first heard it from the Clancy Brothers 40-odd years ago, and as is always the case with first impressions, that's the definitive one for me. I can't find a good quality clip of it, though, so here's a replacement, darn near as good. Jim McCann and the Dubliners. If this doesn't make the bristles stand up on the back of your neck, you've not a drop of Irish blood in you.
I wish I was in Carrickfergus, only for nights in Ballygran. I would swim over deepest ocean, only for nights in Ballygran. But the sea is wide, and I cannot swim over. And neither have I the wings to fly. I wish I had a handsome boatman. to ferry me over. My love and I, now in Kilkenny, it is reported on marble stones there, as black as ink, with gold and silver, I would support her. But I'll sing no more now, till I get a drink, 'cause I'm drunk today, and I'm seldom sober. A handsome rover from town to town. Ah, but I'm sick now. Days are numbered.